It is currently 11 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock, and our guest today in the studio, Carl Asantosky, Executive Director of the Huron County EDC for our What Do You Think program. Thanks for being with us, Carl.
It's always a pleasure.
Not what you said in the office, but okay.
Well, it's not. But, you know, we just try to be accommodating.
Well, I appreciate you coming in today. Start of a new year and more new initiatives, I'm sure, and a lot of changes have happened over the last year, so a lot of the things that you do, you have to look at different directions.
We do.
Is that a continuing challenge, or is it starting to smooth out?
Well, I think it's a continuing challenge. Part of it is there's been a new administration in Lansing, so there's always going to be changes and tweaks and some pretty dramatic changes in some of the programs that we're used to working with at the state level when it comes to economic development. They've re-engineered the economic development process. So we've been...
The point the governor said was not to choose winners or losers, but to try and make it more equal. Is that what I understood
right,
it to be?
Right, is to look at each project individually, do a better accounting, more transparency when it comes to some of the programs. So it's been a challenge. The legislation in certain instances was just passed. The programs have been there. And so they're kind of re-engineering some of the programs that we use.
I imagine this not only makes the changes in how you do it, but you have to start rethinking, you know, you used to know with the old system what kind of a chance you're going to have, you know, if these are the types of things they were looking for, whereas now you're probably back to square one on a lot of that stuff.
Yes. Yes.
One word answer.
Well, yes. It's always a challenge. I mean, and... throughout the years, one of the challenges that we have is that there's always minor program tweaks. They're always changing a little bit. This is dramatic change. For instance, one of the large programs that we have worked with in the past was a tax credit program through the Michigan Economic Growth Authority, a mega tax credit. And those were part of what we look at for brownfield redevelopment, historic preservation, and those kind of things. And what happened was that the governor said, you know, it's really hard to account for those. There's not a lot of transparency because they've been issuing credits for well over 8 years. I think it started actually in the Engler administration, went through Granholm. And when Governor Snyder was elected, he said, you know, we really can't do this. We want to switch this and do it as a pure accounting practice. And we want to make sure that we know what we have on the books at any given point in time. So what the governor and the legislature did was eliminate the mega tax credits for everything.
And did that cause problems for people who were like in the middle of this?
Well, what they did was they provided some cushion.
Okay. So you know, if you're counting on this, you did a whole project probably based on some of this, and all of a sudden, where's the rug under me?
Right. And it was so they, when the governor was elected, came into office last year. One of the first things he did was he said, we're going to eliminate this. But if you've got a application in the process and they've been working on this probably for the last 6 months, ending in December, if you had a project in the pipeline through the end of December, they would honor those tax credits. And they were discussing the opportunity to look at those tax credits as an individual business and kind of weigh that with just an outright payment. Might be discounted, you probably would receive more on the tax credits, but you would have cash in hand. So they've been looking at some creative ways to do that, reduce the exposure on the tax credit side, because those things would be on the state's books for probably up to 15, 20 years, depending on how it's structured. So if they had a project in the pipeline, those were being honored. But starting January 1st, because the mega tax credits were they were a credit against the Michigan business tax. As of January 1st, there is no more business tax, Michigan business tax. It's the flat corporate, the 6% corporate tax. So with that change, what the state wanted to do is they said we wanted to provide a pool for incentives. So if a company's expanding, they're looking at maybe a couple different locations and states throughout the country, or maybe an international expansion. We have a pool of money that we can provide an incentive to have them stay in Michigan or expand in Michigan if they're from outside the area. So the governor and the legislature put together a $100 million pool of money, which is general fund money, so there's no strings. The strings are set by the legislature and the governor. So that program started January 1st. Our challenge, when you talk about tweaks and learning new programs, is that there wasn't any guidelines provided until probably the last month or in December. So we're starting to talk to some companies that might be interested in expansions. They want to understand if there's any incentives. What we've been told is that with the change in the corporate tax, many of the businesses won't be paying any taxes. So that's their incentive to expand. But if they are covered under the 6% corporate tax, there are some opportunities with that $100 million. So the challenge is to learn what the state is expecting from us as local developers to get them interested in a project.
Do you think there's going to be a difference in the type of projects done because you're getting cash up front rather than a long-term tax credit? Because you get more bang for your buck right up front, but down the road you're not getting it. So do you see it as maybe giving them a different approach to how they're going to do things?
I think so. I think before it was a long-term kind of approach, but I think from what we're seeing in some press coverage that we've seen and some of the first projects that are coming in, it's going to be very direct. A company down in the Detroit metro area was thinking of expanding. They were talking about a $15 million investment, but they really needed more electricity. They needed a new electrical substation in order to accommodate this $15 million worth of growth. And they were looking at a couple locations around the country for this. State walked in and said, we'll buy you that substation. And literally, according to what I've read, handed them the company a check for that substation. So it's very direct. It's going to be focused on that development and how to speed the process along instead of a long, drawn-out process, because having sat through some of the mega tax credit deliberations, it could last 3, 4, 6 months. This is very direct. The management at Michigan Economic Development looks at the project, decides that they want to support it, and they can literally write a check. That support could be in the form of grants, just an outright check to the company. Could be as a loan, so they may have to pay that back. And I believe with the substation, that was structured as a loan, so that it would be zero interest or 1% interest over 10 years, and the company would slowly pay it back. It could be a grant loan. Part of it could be a loan. Part of it could be just an outright cash to entice the company to come in. So it depends.
Like rural development does for local communities.
Right.
Could be a grant, could be both.
Could be blended. I mean, and that's part of the challenge, is because as economic developers, we really like knowing the rules going in, so we can talk to our companies about it.
Well, yeah, you don't want to promise them and then find out there's a bunch of strings they can't get through or that they don't want to have to deal with.
Right, or that we don't know if we can help you. we'll get back with you on that, which is okay. I mean, and we're still learning the process. The state is just ramping up the program. They're starting to lay out rules. There's going to be some additional training going on over the next 2 or 3 months. So as the year progresses, we're hoping to have a lot clearer understanding of exactly what they're looking for. Is there going to be, because $100 million seems like a lot, and it's a lot of money to me. I don't know about to you, Craig.
If it came to your office, you'd be like, woohoo.
I would. But when you look at kind of the scope of development across the state, $100 million is not a huge pool of money to draw on.
You were mentioning part of that might be the $25 million for the movie incentives and stuff, so some of that might not even really be available as far as programs you'd be doing.
Right. So that would be, and I'm pretty sure that the $25 million for the film tax credits comes out of that $100 million. So we've got $75 million left, and I believe the last full year of the mega tax credits, there were $300 million worth of tax credits given. So the competition for that $75 million is going to be pretty rigorous when it comes to, who they're looking at. The state obviously wants to get more bang for their buck. So we've been told kind of the initial cutoff is projects less than $100,000 the state really doesn't want to look at. So we've got to kind of start judging that, and we don't know if that's $100,000 of private investment, if that's $100,000 project, a new electrical line or a new road Is that what they're looking at? So we're trying to work with the state and work with our contacts to better understand exactly how those systems are going to work.
In the past, most of these systems, grants and such, came with some strings usually attached to jobs. Is that still part of the focus, that you're either creating or retaining jobs in order to get the expansion you're looking for?
Yes. And that's part of the evaluation. Before, it was they had some pretty rigorous standards as far as job creation. I mean, obviously, more jobs, the better. But they also factor in private investment. Is the local community contributing anything for roads or streets or those type of things? So it's, and they're still keeping that. I think what's changed a lot as well is that there's going to be a lot more clarity and transparency when it comes to reporting. Where did that $100 million go? What did we get for it? You know, if the state tax, or $75 million, if the film credits come out of that, where did that $75 million go? And from our perspective, we want to make sure that at least portions of it come out to rural areas, in particular in the Upper Thumb area.
And do you see a lot of this perhaps going to smaller businesses, smaller rather than, you know, big automakers or something, which where you've got, they've got resources around the world, as opposed to, you know, a company that's just based here?
I would like to think that it would be evenly assessed and that there would be some balance. I think the challenge is, you know, especially if one of the criteria is bigger is better. I mean, if we're going to invest, if I'm the governor and I have to invest $5 million in a project, and or I'm investing state dollars, which are limited, where am I going to get the most bang for my buck? Am I going to get it in, you know, rural areas, which we represent? And in some cases, there may be some investments that we can provide to them, or businesses that are expanding, that it makes sense. My guess is that a lot of the programs, especially when you start looking at brownfields and historic preservation, those kind of, they're going to trend towards more urban areas, higher densities. There's more brownfields. I mean, you look at Metro Detroit, Flint, I mean, any of the urban areas, they've got huge brownfield areas. Not saying that we don't, but the size of the projects that we would be able to put on the table compared to what Flint would be able to put on the table, I mean, they kind of pale in comparison. So we want to make sure that our voices are heard, that we've got, you know, projects that are viable for the state's perspective and that are competitive. So we'll be watching where that money goes, you know, how it's invested, and, you know, and we've seen legislators say that $100 million may not be enough. They may have to look at adding some more money. I just read an article in Business Week that I believe Florida has a $300 million pool for incentive programs. So it's a competitive environment. I mean, we're competing. One of the big unknowns, and it'll be interesting to see, is the change in the corporate tax to a flat 6%, which eliminates a lot of businesses in the area because of their corporate structure. They don't have to pay those taxes. It'll be interesting to see how all that kind of ripples through the economy.
And it remains to be seen what type of tweaking may come down from Lansing, because every time they pass some sort of revolutionary tax bill, then come the tweaks, which turn it into what it was before.
Yes, yes.
Not trying to be that pessimistic from the start, but it's I've seen it through the years, and it's happening probably as we speak.
A great case in point is we had a couple Renaissance zones up here that have since, they weren't successful, have since kind of went back on the tax rolls. But in other communities, they have Renaissance zones. And I believe it was in Lansing, where part of the Renaissance zone was a residential development. And part of the sale of that residential development, it was condos and those kind of things down by the baseball stadium, kind of that whole redevelopment area, was that there were no taxes. If you lived there, you wouldn't have to pay income tax. State income tax, which is not a bad deal. But when the legislature eliminated all those mega tax credits in the Michigan business tax, they also eliminated those tax credits.
Which means you may see a lot of these units on the market because they were getting a benefit that allowed them to live there.
No, the legislature tweaked it.
They did?
So they gave the credits back to those folks. So when you mentioned the tweaks, they're already starting to take place. I mean, the changes have occurred. They realized that it was kind of a blanket.
This would only be in effect through what would have been the life of the Renaissance Zone anyway, so eventually it is going to go off.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's not like it's a permanent thing.
Right. And it was an incentive to get people to look at those locations that might be a little tougher to sell in downtowns and those kind of places, in those redevelopment areas.
And do you think they're going to be looking at the kind of jobs created, whether they're ones you can live on, you get benefits, as opposed to being service jobs where, you know, you're maybe making minimum wage? Or do they just count a job as a job as a job?
No, they look at the wages. Yeah. They do look at benefits, wages, private investment are typically the three things that the company will bring in to the equation when we start looking at what kind of incentives might be out there.
Because the point of new jobs is hopefully to get Michigan residents who aren't working back to work and at something that they can live at.
Absolutely. Some of the language that we've seen leads us to believe that they're going to be looking at more downtown, so that if there's a redevelopment in a downtown area, you know, and again, this is part of the struggle that we look at and that we try to raise with our legislators and with the folks at Michigan Economic Development is, in the language for that $100 million pool of money, there's three or four references to urban centers. When I think of urban centers, I think of Bad Axe and Pigeon and Sandusky and Caro. But
nobody in Lansing thinks of those as urban centers.
They don't. They don't. They think of urban centers as downtown Detroit. And when you see some of the investment that's going on by the gentleman who owns the Quicken Loans, Dan Gilbert, is bought, I think, five buildings in downtown Detroit, all of them historic, all of them, you know, and he has the financial wherewithal to start investing, redeveloping those properties. Part of that equation might be part of that $100 million. And the state
Detroit is a drop in the bucket with $100 million. Small communities around the state could make a nice dent.
That's our point, is that the investment from the state could be significantly less. You know, $1 million in a rural area is a huge, huge impact as compared to $1 million in downtown Detroit, which is kind of a drop in the bucket.
We redid the sidewalks on a block.
There are
other things you have to pay down there, and people and such, and we won't go into that.
I'm sorry, I'm not going there. But that's the challenge. And when we read some of the initial language, we just raised the red flag. We called the state and said, you know, these are interesting programs. We're not opposed to, you know, the changes or anything else. We want some clarity as far as what urban means, because in our minds, urban is a lot different than Ann Arbor urban or Lansing or Detroit urban, or Grand Rapids. So,
and urban centers and small communities are facing the same problems as the big cities anyway.
Absolutely. In our cases, is that an investment in a small rural community like Bad Axe or Sandusky or Caro will make a huge impact for a lot less money than, you know, redoing sidewalks at $1 million per, you know, block in downtown Detroit or Grand Rapids. So there's the scale is different. We've been assured that they're going to be looking at rural areas as well as, you know, that county seats would be considered urban centers. Our concern is that, you know, that money's going to disappear very quickly. And does the state have the finances in order to put, you know, put money into that? We've been hopeful.
Now, you were mentioning this could be loans as well.
Correct.
Will those loans accrue over the years to where you'll have like a revolving type of fund where this might grow and maybe next year you'd have $1.2 million because it's coming back and staying with the program as you've had programs
right.
that did in the past?
No.
No. You're one-word answer today, aren't you?
Well, they are structured as loans, but the loans go back to the state. They're not they don't reside in the communities as in the past. I know we've had loans.
Well, I mean, even if it went back to the state and then next year they had $102 million to send out, that would be a program that could grow over the
absolutely.
Years.
Absolutely, and that's what we're hoping. That's what they're hoping to see, and that's what we're hoping to see. I mean, if they can make loans. Our experience is that governments aren't really good at making loans, so we're a little anxious about that. But we're trusting our leadership down in Lansing, so that it'll be an interesting process. I mean, it's exciting. It's a totally different approach than past administrations. So we're hopeful that we can offer some good projects out here, some good ideas, and kind of move our efforts forward at the local level.
Now, late last year, you did put in some applications for grants or loans concerning brownfields.
We did.
How is that progressing, or won't you know for quite a while the way things are, you know, the machinery moves slowly?
It does move slowly.
We are into the fiscal year. I didn't know if this is maybe for next fiscal year.
I think technically it is.
So we may not know till close to October when you're getting money.
We'll know before then. The grant applications that we applied for were new to us, and in the same aspect, kind of old. Huron County, we're finishing up a 3-year program where we're doing brownfield assessments. We have a EPA grant where we can go in, and if there's a development project or a prospective development project, we can pay for soil testing, baseline environmentals, due care plans. I mean, all the way up to, we can't pay for the cleanup. We can't put a shovel in the ground, but we can do soil borings, kind of prep that site for development.
That way, any potential buyer knows what's there and what needs to be addressed, and can factor that in as whether this is going to be cost-effective to use that site.
And it protects the, and in most cases, probably not all, but most cases, what happens is that a potential developer needs protection. They want to make sure that they're not responsible, and they can document that they're not responsible for contamination on that site. If they don't go through the right steps, the courts have found that, you know, Craig just bought what used to be an old gas station and didn't go through any of the base, any of the studies, the environmental work that should be done. Suddenly you're responsible for that.
Even though your business does not pump gas or do anything like
exactly.
that, but you find that under there, and it's your land and you inherited it when you bought it.
Right. So what we're able to do is we were able to go in before you buy it, do the analysis, soil borings, history of that site, what's been there, all the way up, but not including cleanup, and deliver that to you. And then you can take that, and you're protected from any pest. You may have what's called due care responsibility, so that you can't, that site shouldn't be endangering the public health. So if there was leaking gas tanks and there's, you have to, we have to come up with a way, and that's where part of the grant can help, is to design a program that'll help address any kind of public health factors. And we've done that.
Sounds like it would also help when you're applying for financing, that the people know that this isn't going to come back to haunt you, and you're going to be able to work and pay off your loan.
And banks, a lot of banks and financial institutions require these now, not always, but most times. So,
and people might not be, you think gas stations, but there's a lot of other businesses that use chemicals, like dry cleaners. I mean, all kinds of places can have stuff that in the old days, we threw it out the back door. And you don't do that anymore.
Buried fuel oil tanks. A fuel oil tank above ground that leaked. So there's
even not having your parking lot paved if there was, fuel being dispensed because you had a fleet of trucks or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
That could have been something that caused leakage into the ground.
Right. And we're limited to, we can only look at commercial and industrial sites. We can't go into residential. We've had a couple requests, and we've had to turn them down because we just can't do that. So it's a way to protect developers, new property owners from doing that. We're finishing up. We received $400,000, $200,000 for petroleum-based sites, gas stations, and then $200,000 for non-petroleum, just hazardous material. It could be old landfills and those kind of things.
Factories you're trying to put back into use, and
right.
the people coming in might be concerned about what was done there before.
Exactly. There's oil spots on the cement. You know, does that go under the cement? You know, is that in the aquifers and those kind of things? So what we're able to do is to go in and due diligence on that site. We're finishing up that project. And when we started talking about, looking at reapplying, we discovered that, what the EPA and the federal government is doing is looking at larger impact projects. So we kind of made a calculation that said rural areas, especially Huron County, probably wouldn't be competitive anymore because the state wants, or the federal government wants, larger impact areas. So what we did was, as we started looking at applying for this, we called Sanilac County and Tuscola County and said, do you want to partner with us and put together a regional three-county effort to apply for the new round of EPA grants? And they were most gracious and said yes. So there are a lot of hurdles because the approaches were a little different. And so we overcame that. And we applied for actually two grants. One is $1 million assessment grant, which would mirror exactly what we're doing now. And the other two counties...
For the layperson, $1 million assessment grant, about how many would that do? It sounds expensive to me.
We've done projects for as little as $3,000 or $4,000 each. We've done we've done projects that might cost $75,000 to $80,000 each. So it's a nice opportunity. And again, because we're looking at a three-county regional area, it gives us a lot of resources. And the agreement was, and this is kind of part of the negotiation, is that the resources, if we're successful and get the grant, will go where the projects are. So we decided that we're not going to carve that $1 million up if we're successful and say, you know, this is Huron County's part.
You get $333,000, you get $333,000.
We decided that probably wasn't a good approach, you know, from a federal perspective, that, you know, is just three individual grants that were given out, and that's not an effective use of resources. But if we let the resources flow in the three counties where the projects are, so that if Vassar has a big project redeveloping one of their closed factories, those resources can flow down there. And, you know, from our perspective, folks from Huron County will probably be working down there anyway. So... $1 million for the assessment program across three counties.
Is there a time limit? How long do you have to spend it? Three years.
So, and we're bumping up. We're getting close to spending down that $400,000 that we had for Huron County. So we think that the assessment will work out pretty well. Because you get into a big industrial site or a former industrial site, there's a lot of soil testing that has to be done, especially if there was trucks or any kind of rail service. Rail, we've discovered, is always interesting.
It's not just, you know, the fuel for the train. I mean, it's the stuff they carry, and it may not even be going through to you. It could be going on to the next person, but it's still there, and it could have been leaking.
Oh, exactly. I mean, and this is historic, you know, for the last 200 years. However long that rail line has been there, you know, there's been traffic on it, and who knows what's been in the cars. It might have been fertilizer. It could have been petrochemicals. So we want to make sure that we cover those kind of areas. So we've got a $1 million assessment, and we thought that, and that's okay, but there's no recourse. You do a site assessment on your brownfield, and what do you do, you know, when you get the report? How do you pay for the cleanup? So what we did was we applied for a $1 million revolving loan fund, kind of what we were talking about previously, where it's, and this one would stay local. It comes back into the area.
The three-county area.
We would have to set up some kind of administrative group that would manage both programs, and we've kind of developed an initial outline for that. If we're successful in getting the grants, that's when it gets complicated, and we have to sit down around the table, put a pot of coffee on, and settle our differences and decide how we're going to manage it. But the revolving loan fund is interesting because we don't have any experience. Sanilac County is taking the lead on that because they do have a small revolving loan fund just for Sanilac County. They have a couple $100,000 in the revolving loan fund, and what we were able to do is work out an agreement that we could use their revolving loan fund as match for the $1 million. So it's a great cooperative effort in the region, leverages resources. They have the experience and expertise with the revolving loan fund that we don't have. So we were able to put that into the grant application. We think that that's a huge benefit when it looks at a competitive aspect when we go through the grant review process.
Now, assessments sound costly. Cleanup sounds mega costly.
Even more costly.
So I assume you're going to have to prioritize what you can get done and the needs of the business, as opposed to, you know, if they just need, maybe you can do five as opposed to just one big one, and those types of things.
Right, and that's part of what the management team will look at. And we're looking at a couple folks from each county who would set down on a monthly basis, see if there's any projects coming in, if those projects, and kind of work through that process. You know, are there jobs created? What's the private investment? The $1 million is not just for a loan to the company. It's a loan to clean up that site. So depending on the ultimate reuse, in some sites, it's sometimes better just to cap the site. So you put a parking, you put an asphalt parking lot over the site, and it isolates that, doesn't get moisture going through it, doesn't go down into the aquifer. So depends on what the ultimate reuse is. You know, if it's a contaminated site and you're proposing a residential development, the cleanup requirements are a lot more strict for something like that than if you were going to build a factory on the same site. So it depends on location, depends on ultimate reuse, a lot of those factors. But the revolving loan itself would be structured just for paying for part of the cleanup cost. And there are other ways that we can structure brownfield deals, too, that will use local taxes to help reimburse for the cleanup cost.
And the benefits to the community is that sites that aren't being used will get reused. They're not using new virgin territories that are encroaching into
right.
agricultural lands and other things, because usually you need a big chunk of land.
Right.
And
The infrastructure is typically
there.
Sewer, water, roads you don't have to pay for. You may have to upgrade them a little bit, but all of the lines are there. Electrical service, I mean, sometimes if the site's adjacent to rail, you've got transportation covered. So it makes some sense. And if those sites are contaminated and they're just sitting there, there's no taxes being paid. They're degrading the environment because of whatever the contaminants are, just kind of leaching out into the environment. So it's a win for the community. It's a win for the business. And by using these grants and loans, it's an incentive to look at those sites in a new way, and we think a really good way for the communities.
Okay. We talked a little bit about certain things before the before the show. And one of the things we talked about, as we even at the beginning of the show, we talked about the changes in Lansing. And one of the changes has been with the depreciation and such for the wind turbines. And TREC is a group that your office is heavily a part of.
Yes.
And was looking at the financial benefits of the wind turbines to local governments. And now all of that's probably out the window, and you have to do a whole lot of recalculating.
Well, just for the folks that are listening, TREC is the Thumb Regional Renewable Energy Collaborative.
It has nothing to do with Scotty and Mr. Spock.
No. And we started this probably about three and a half years ago to better understand the renewable energy development, the wind farms that are coming in the area. And being our approach is economic development, so we look at taxes and jobs.
And we were kind of the first in the state with major ones.
We were.
So there was nowhere else to go as far as Michigan law and Michigan incentives and stuff. It all had to be created the first time
created.
Around.
Created. And as we better understood 3 years ago and even before, as the first projects, the first two projects were being developed and built, there were changes in state law. The project in Ubley was actually built before the Renewable Portfolio Standard, which requires Michigan utilities to have 10% of their generation from renewables by 2015. That created the market for renewable energy in Michigan, that change. So the two projects, Pigeon and Ubley, were done prior to the Renewable Portfolio Standard.
But they can be included now. Their values probably went up a little bit when that happened, because somebody has to be using that energy to write off their 15%.
Right. Because part of the mechanics of this is that when you have to have a power purchase agreement. I can't just go out and build a utility scale, a 50 turbine, 100 megawatt wind park without knowing where I'm going to sell that electricity. And there's a lot of steps involved in the process. But ultimately, the state changed, passed the Renewable Portfolio Standard. And when they did that, the federal government had been updating all of the wind maps, the wind resource maps. And lo and behold, the Thumb area was one of the better locations for wind energy in the state of Michigan. And there are other locations, too. But there are other factors that drive the location process. But Trek wanted to better understand the tax structure and job creation. Job creation, we found out, was pretty straightforward. Kind of the rule of thumb that we've been told over and over again is that these projects, not the construction portion, but the long-term operation and maintenance, is usually one job created for every 10 turbines. So with the new project, like down in Minden City, long-term, they'll probably create, you know, 5 to 8 jobs in there someplace. Depends on how they're structured.
And it depends if they already are from the same company as one nearby, because they can share administrative costs and such, because it's just...
Absolutely. I believe the company that developed that, Exelon Energy, is the same developer up in Pigeon, which is getting ready to expand. They just bought the old intermediate school district building on Soper Road as kind of their central hub location. So they can service both areas with the same technicians. Part of the whole technician thing is some companies will choose to subcontract that out, where if I'm Carl Ossentoski Wind Developer, I don't want to be, you know, having to crawl up in 300 feet to repair those wind turbines. So what I might do is to hire Vestas, which is the manufacturer, just to have their technicians do the maintenance on those things. General Electric does the same thing. So it depends on the company's approach. So as we've kind of moved through this, the challenge has always been the taxes. We initially, when we first started, one of the big things that we were focusing on was something called the Next Energy Authority. That program, interestingly enough, was a 100% tax abatement on wind farm developments. And it wasn't set up originally for wind farms. It was set up to encourage alternative energy manufacturing. So if you were doing a gear for a wind turbine in your manufacturing facility and you had to buy a new piece of equipment and add more people, you could get 100% tax credit on that piece of equipment, which is a great incentive to get involved into that industry. Through the years, what the folks down in Lansing interpreted wind turbines and wind farms as being eligible for that. So our initial concern was is that as these new wind farms were developing, that they would be asking for the Next Energy Authority tax abatement. And we discovered that the abatement program works kind of backwards from the programs that we're used to dealing with, which are industrial tax abatements, which a factory would approach a local business, say, we're thinking about expanding. Could we get 50% tax abatement on our equipment and our buildings? Local community makes the decision and then sends it to Lansing for final approval. What happens with the Next Energy Authority, it works in the reverse process. The wind farm developer would apply to Michigan Economic Development, Next Energy Authority. Typically, if all the paperwork's in order, they issue a 100% tax abatement. And then the local communities have a 60-day window to either not do anything, which they concur with what the state has done and the tax abatement goes through, or they have to opt out, which is they have to pass a resolution that removes the local units of government from that abatement. We've discovered that, interestingly enough, the school district and the township are the only ones that can opt out. And the township literally would controls if they don't opt out, the county loses all of the taxes associated with that, senior citizens, libraries, transportation, townships, everybody loses if they don't opt out. And that occurred actually in Maasauke County. There was a wind project where they were developing 9 wind turbines up in Maasauke County, just outside of McBain. The communities chose not to opt out, and so they lost revenue until the end of 2012 on all of those initial 9 wind turbines. So we wanted to make sure that we were educating our local townships and schools that they had the option to opt out. We didn't tell them, and we would never tell them, you know, what they would do, But, you know, this is what we tried to do is to present the case that, you know, this is what you would lose on taxes, this is what the school would lose, and this is how it impacts not just the township, who may not need the taxes, but impacts all of the other taxing units in the county for that wind development. So, and then as the efforts evolved, there's been some discussions about the changes in... We've discovered that they're not called depreciation schedules. They're trend multipliers. Because, interestingly enough, there's lots of factors that go into it. It's not a straight... in a lot of cases, especially with electrical generation equipment, it's not a trend line that automatically goes down. In some situations, gas turbines, they actually might increase in value. So it's not just a straight downward trend necessarily. So the initial... what we discovered was that the initial trend multipliers were, they started off at 100% and over 15 years dropped to 30%. And we thought those were pretty aggressive. And we started talking at the state level about that. Just recently, the State Tax Commission issued a new trend multiplier that goes from the first year, the value of those wind development goes to 80% automatically. And then drops to 30% over 6 years. So when you compare the two, the old one with the new one, it's an effective 27% tax cut on the wind developers. So,
and when you say that, that's 27% of that revenue that you're not going to be getting locally for roads and the other things that you were,
senior
you
citizen,
were thinking this was
exactly.
going to help to finance.
Library, senior citizens, transit. I mean, all of those pieces, schools, medical care, are all impacted by that. And, you know, a 27% cut. And that's, you know, when you start looking at the numbers, they're huge numbers. So we've started the process. We've been talking with Michigan Association of Counties, with the Michigan Township Association. What started off with TREC initially as Huron Tuscola Sanilac kind of talking with the townships and counties individually, we've gone to, at our last meeting, we had Gratiot, we had Mason, we had Maskee County. We're going to be reaching out to Bay and Saginaw counties because the new development in Tuscola County kind of goes over into those respective counties. We had township representation from Guilford Township, from Minden Township, from the folks in Gratiot County. In Huron County Township. So what we wanted to do is to better educate our local communities and to work with the folks at the state level to better understand why there was a change in the depreciation schedule, trend multiplier schedules.
And the advantage to this is that when you reach out to these other people to help them, you get a bigger voice.
Exactly.
And when something comes up like this and you want to say, hey, what's going on here, it's not just three people from Huron County's commissioners in your office. It's you know, people from 8-9 different counties already.
10 or 15 counties. And that was Senator Green actually suggested that to the TREC group. He said, you know, you're three rural counties. You know, I'm your voice in Lansing. He said, and I've got a limited impact because I'm one state senator. But if you reach out to those other counties that are anticipating development or have development, then suddenly it's not just my voice, it's three or four state senators. And then there's all of the representatives from those communities. So suddenly it starts making more of an impact. And that's what we've been doing over the last 3 years is reaching out to those communities, educating them, talking with them about, you know, what we've been able to find out, what have they found out, you know, and it's a education process both ways.
Because you have a track record. You have gone through it,
right.
I mean, as opposed to the people who are just seeing what's coming down
right.
the pike, and you've been there.
And you know, we're not looking to, you know, ask for more taxes other than what's been promised. I mean, we moved into this process with the understanding that there would be taxes paid, and this is what the schedule was. And then, you know, the folks down in Lansing changed the trend schedules. And so we're just trying to understand why that happened, you know, what they were using as factors, how did they determine that, you know, is that a good business model if suddenly, you know, you're
your first year, you've lost 20%.
20%, and then you go out and build a new one. How is it, you know, we want to understand what the thought process was. So we're starting to, you know, talk to each other. And again, you know, by reaching out to those other counties and townships around the state, it increases the weight of our argument, we think.
We're getting kind of down to the end of our time here. Quick thing, we do have a new loop coming through for the thumb for energy to handle all these wind turbines. Apparently, our system currently is like old knob and tube. Just can't handle the load.
The old 120 power line that came into the area was pretty old and was not the most stable structure in the world. So with the wind farm development that's going on, ITC, which is the owner of the power lines, the big transmission lines, is putting in a 345,000 volt dual feed, dual circuit power line that starts over in Saginaw County, comes through Tuscola, and then starts down in St. Clair County, comes up through Sanilac, and hopefully they meet in the middle, and they're not 3 feet off. The engineers are pretty good, we've been told. So, but it will stabilize the upper thumb grid. You know, if there's a weather event where those power lines go down, they can actually feed from either direction, where that's not possible now. So it stabilizes the grid, gives us more redundancy in the area. So it's a very good thing for the upper thumb area. You know, with the addition of the wind park or the wind farms, it stabilizes the grid and gives us some opportunities, because now we have a stable, pretty significant power grid up here that we might be able to look at, you know, what other opportunities. Are there other biomass opportunities, solar opportunities, those kind
of
things.
We're going to have to wrap it up, Carl. We're running out of time here.
Craig!
Just keep going. We'll talk another day.
Okay.
I thank you for being with us today. Our guest has been Carl Asentosky, Executive Director of the Huron County EDC Office in Bad Axe. Your number is, if people have questions,
989-269-6431.
And your open work hours?
8 until 5 every day.
So if you have questions or you want to talk about some of the programs we talked about, give Carl's office a call. They'll get you the info you need. Coming up at 11, we'll clue you in on the latest in the news.
Chances are, if you're reading about hearing loss, you've already been dealing with it for some time. Studies show that people with progressive hearing loss wait an average of 5 to 15 years before seeking treatment. Hearing loss can create many negative effects, both on the individual with the loss and his or her family, friends, or coworkers. Individuals with hearing loss are more likely to experience tension, irritation, or frustration at communication.